It's Wednesday, April 14, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the CDC and FDA say they want another look at the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Make sure it's safe after six women experienced dangerous blood clots. Six out of nearly 7 million people who got that shot. We're going to talk about the communications challenges this development presents. Tucker Carlson and his bosses at Fox are standing down on his on-air comments in support of a known white supremacist theory. And viewers across Britain flood the BBC with complaints. Yes, Prince Philip died, but did they really need to preempt all other programming for as long as they did? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with the news that's coming out of Minneapolis in the suburbs, where the nation's attention was already focused on the Derek Chauvin trial when there was even more tragic news, the death of another black motorist after a police officer in a nearby suburb shot that man on Sunday. Covering the trial itself presents an emotional challenge for the reporters who are in that courtroom every day. Sunday night, Monday night, last night again, they're in the streets going from the courtroom during the day into the streets at night, covering another event at the hands, if you will, of another police officer.
Yeah, and it's tough for the reporters, but it's also, I mean, I think it's tough on everyone in that region right now. I mean, just before the taping of the show, the prosecutor has decided to charge the officer, Kim Potter, mm-hmm. in the suburb of Minneapolis with second-degree manslaughter. So now you've got another case that's headed toward court. You have calls for even more restrictions against police officers. The chief of that police department has resigned. So now you have news organizations having to send more reporters in. More reporters are having to deal with the trauma that they're experiencing in all of this. So it's one of those things where as journalists, we can get it right, or we can just continue to do some stereotypical coverage. And I think you're going to see both of that. But one of the things I am seeing is that they're trying to provide more depth, more context. But they're also trying to ask the right questions and sort of make sure that they're covering it on all bases. So I think the journalism did learn something from the coverage of the trial, but they also learned something from the coverage from last summer as well.
One of the things that I've been seeing on Twitter, somebody shared with me a tweet from last night that journalism schools, they wish journalism schools would do something and provide resources and help journalists learn how to better cope with covering these types of traumas. And my first thought was, don't they realize we're trying to learn this and manage these things right alongside? There isn't really a playbook that exists yet for this level of trauma reporting of what we have been seeing over the course of the past year to 15 months.
Yeah, I think the difference is we certainly know about taking care of journalists who have covered traumatic events. I think the big difference now, and it's certainly something I hear from a lot of students, is the concern that the journalists themselves will be targets. You know, in the past, the kind of trauma that we've had to deal with is sometimes we have to cover events that are very hard and sad or violent. But it's not aimed at us. And a lot of these protests, for one reason or another, for one group or another, and sometimes both sides, the journalists start to become targets. So one of the things we're talking about here, and I'm sure in other journalism schools, is how do you anticipate problems and defuse those situations, and when do you know when to get out? And just the fact that I'm having to talk to young journalists about this is a little bit traumatic for me. And I've had conversations with some of our students where I've trotted out some of the tactics I used And I've been told, you know, that might work for you, Professor Kiley, but you're white. And they have a point. So I think, you know, I think we're all grappling with it. But I certainly think that one thing that this, if anybody had any doubt that this is a systemic problem as opposed to a one-off, this incident corroborates it. We have a systemic problem we have to deal with in a systemic way. We can't do this one case by one case by one case. And so all of us, I think, whether we are in the institution of journalism or the institution of policing or the institution of the public policymakers who deal with the police, we have got to deal with this as a systemic problem.
Well, I'll push back a little bit. It's actually not pushing back. It's provide a little historical context. Journalists who were covering the civil rights movement back in the 50s and 60s and even into the early 70s, they were in the line of fire. Many of them were injured. Some of them were injured badly. I mean, if you go back and you study this, you will see that. I remember as a young reporter covering the uprisings in South Central Los Angeles after Rodney King, I remember going into that, where I was the black reporter, but I was also accompanied by a white photographer, and the danger that he put him that he was in during that time, because he was trying to photograph and document what was going on during that time period, and in many cases he was the only white person in the vicinity. And oftentimes I had to act as an intermediary to protect him. So journalists find themselves in these situations all the time. But I think what's different here is the fact that during those time periods, it wasn't happening in real time.
The 24-hour news cycle wasn't what it is today.
You didn't have social media. You didn't have Facebook Live and all these other things. So I think that that brings an added element to it.
Yes, and I think what the difference now is that it prompts all of those elements that are new. Promote copycatting.
Absolutely.
So suddenly it's not just one person or a one group of people on a particular street corner. Suddenly this has gone viral.
Right.
Let's go get the press.
Right.
And of course, as we've said innumerable times on this show, the rhetoric doesn't help by certain segments
absolutely.
of the political sector.
And I think what sort of has an impact on us as educators is that we're having to also deal with this in real time, because our students who know that they're going to be these are the careers that they've chosen to go into, know that they're going to be in those situations, and they want to know, how do I handle myself in these situations?
Exactly. And what I was saying before is some of the things I used to do don't work anymore, or they're not appropriate in this situation, because it's a scarier time.
It's a much scarier time.
Well, so fewer than 24 hours before Dante Wright's killing, this very obvious commentary ran on Saturday Night Live, showing the stark differences in perspectives between journalists of different races.
I thought the prosecution did an excellent job questioning the medical examiner.
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
Yep. Yeah, but the video footage alone should tell you everything you need to know about what happened.
100%.
No doubt about it.
Okay, and hopefully justice will be served.
That'd be nice.
God willing. Sounds like we all agree there's no way Derek Chauvin walks away from this.
Okay, wait a second. You guys aren't buying into Chauvin's defense, are you?
Of course not.
I mean, the defense trying to make a case that George Floyd's drug use was somehow responsible is just deplorable.
It was a clear act of desperation to create doubt where there is none.
Exactly, and there's no way the jury's gonna fall for that.
Wait, so what are you guys trying to say?
Look, y'all seem like good people.
Let's just say we've seen this movie before.
Boom!
You know what? That's fair. I think skepticism of the legal process is valid.
There you go.
All we're saying. Yeah, historically, police have gotten away in other cases like this.
Historically?
She means every single time.
Oh. Got it.
Okay, so we're laughing, and We're laughing because it's not funny.
It's frankly. Not funny.
In all I mean, of the ways it's not funny. And we're going to actually be playing another clip from that sketch a little bit later in the show. If you haven't had an opportunity to watch it yet, obviously Kathy and Ernest have, but I encourage you to go to our Links blog and watch it in full because it really does communicate that message that the Black community has seen this movie before.
Yep.
And the outcome in so many ways, it's better than likely that Chauvin walks in some way or that the defense is able to make that play for reasonable doubt because that's what has always happened.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, and there is a lot of doubt as to whether or not this is going to, whether or not justice is going to be served here. Because justice, when it comes to Black people in the criminal justice system, is different than it is for whites. That is, you know, and the piece talks about it, historically true. It is true in a lot of instances, especially when you're talking about their relationship with law enforcement. And law enforcement, on more often than not, comes out on the side where they're innocent. Even when the evidence is there and everyone sees it, you know, it's still, you know, comes out the other way because the jury may have believed one thing or another. I mean, you never know.
So this case is in a lot of ways being the defense is rooted in a lot of racial stereotypes. One of the things we are seeing, though, and this is in part, we've talked about this, the creation of a lot of race and culture beats, an emergence of journalists of color who are in much more prominent roles. And there are a couple of articles also on our Links blog that have highlighted some of those. But one of the other things that we're seeing, too, is an emergence of a new Black press, both in Minneapolis and in other markets as well, covering it in a way that brings some more of that nuance that hasn't been seen previously.
Yeah, many of these organizations have been out there. Many of the Black press, they've been covering these communities for a while. They cover it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. They are advocacy organs, and they pretty much... Our philosophy of straight down the middle, we're going to just give you the facts, doesn't necessarily fit in with what they're doing. They're saying, look, these are the lived experiences of the people that we live with and work with and cover on a daily basis. And they see this story in a different light. And we're going to present that light to that audience as well as a much larger audience on platforms in which they see themselves. So they're on social media. They're on everyone's phones and on their tablets. They're not necessarily you're able to pick it up off of the rack the way you would a newspaper or watch it on television. And they're reaching an audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and hopefully part of that audience is the mainstream press. I mean, I think one of the frustrating things about this is we have seen this movie before. You know, there was a period when affirmative action was really important in newsrooms and we were promoting journalists of color. And then a lot of newsrooms backslid. And there were also efforts to get the, to raise up. I mean, there's a history of a really vibrant Black press that has kind of withered and now maybe being born again. And I would hope, you know, when I was starting out as a reporter in Pittsburgh, we used to read the Pittsburgh Courier all the time because, which was it's a very storied African-American newspaper. And I felt that it gave me as a reporter a perspective that I didn't get otherwise. And so I think that if in that way, it can influence the coverage far beyond just the community or the particular audience they're trying to reach if mainstream reporters are smart enough to consume this information.
So I also want to talk about Tucker Carlson again. Thursday night, he had a guest on his show, and in their discussion ended up talking about the Great Replacement Theory. It's a white supremacist conspiracy theory shouted through the streets of Charlottesville, cited as the reason for the shootings in Christchurch, and at the root of the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Friday, just before the start of the Jewish Sabbath, the Anti-Defamation League called on Fox News to fire Carlson and to regain control of its airwaves. Some might call this another act of cancel culture, an attempt to silence the speech of someone with whom you don't agree. ADL President Jonathan Greenblatt went on CNN's Reliable Sources Sunday to say this is no such thing.
This is not cancel culture. Let me be unambiguous about it. There has always been room for fringe ideas in America. That's a function of our First Amendment, and I embrace that. The question is, does Fox should take these fringe ideas and put them where they belong, on the fringe, not place them in prime time where they serve as a gateway drug to tens of millions of Americans, right? To literally conscript them into this conspiracy theory of violent white supremacy. We can't afford to look away any longer, Brian. It's incumbent upon, again, from advertisers to the cable companies to the shareholders to say there is just too much risk in his racism and he's got to go.
So, Ernest, on Monday night, Tucker Carlson doubled down on his statements mocking that conversation on CNN. The management, the Murdoch response, shows that Fox is kind of sort of okay with what's going on here.
Yeah, they're okay with it because it's bringing in the ratings. His ratings, and Kathy said the money.
Kathy's doing the money.
Yeah. It's the ratings and the money. I mean, and when you've got Sean Hannity on one side and Tucker Carlson backing him up, I mean, you've got a 1-2 punch there that is producing a lot of revenue for Fox News. And right now, one of their concerns is that they're out of power. The Republicans are out, and that's their base, the base of their viewership, and they want to continue to keep those viewers there. Plus, they're being bombarded, and because you have other media outlets that are coming after that base, that core base of viewers that Fox has. And right now, Hannity and Tucker Carlson are the two. Basically, the 1-2 punch. I mean, if you want to use a baseball analogy, I mean, they're your two best starting pitchers in your 5-man rotation, and they're going to keep running them out there. And for Tucker Carlson, this works. I mean,
his ratings are enormous right now. Yeah. And I think, you know, this gets to what I call the pogo problem when I talk about news literacy and people come to us and say, why is the news media the way it is? Well, it's because you pick the media you get.
That's right.
What are people clicking on? What are people choosing in their ratings? And so, you know, like Pogo, the little cartoon character, used to look in the mirror and the caption was, we have met the enemy and it is us. So as long as people keep driving those ratings, and we see that opinion sells. You know, I'm old enough to remember when you could go on cable TV at night and there would actually be reported news stories airing. And now it's just, it was a long time ago.
I think
when you were just a baby. Yeah,
back in my childhood, we watched actual reported news.
Much cheaper to just have studio wrestling, you know, where you bring in opinionators and everybody does it.
Studio wrestling used to be on when I was a child.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it is now, but it's verbal studio. About that level of sophistication.
But these conspiracy theories, I mean, they are dangerous.
They are absolutely dangerous.
And I think Greenblatt made an excellent point, which is, you know, and I feel the same way. I'm the chair of Free Press Studies, but everybody has a right to their opinion. Not everybody has a right to worldwide publication and circulation. And that is where news organizations and also the web platforms have to start to exercise some responsibility. But I think the main hope here is going to be the advertisers.
So talk about that for a second, because one of the things, too, that Greenblatt also said in this interview was that it worked until it stopped working. And if we look at historical, he brought up specifically Father Coughlin back in the 1930s, brought up Lou Dobbs, also on Fox Business, some other people for whom this worked until the advertisers said enough is enough. Can you see a point where that's happening here? Because I'm looking into the future and I'm wondering when it's happening.
It happened with Bill O'Reilly.
Okay, Bill
O'Reilly.
I mean,
Bill O'Reilly is no longer on the air because he went so far that the advertisers couldn't take it. So if I were the Anti-Defamation League or anybody who feels justifiably defamed by the racist bigotry that Tucker is peddling to get ratings, I would be looking at the list of advertisers and saying, who's advertising on the show? And let's organize a boycott, let's organize a letter writing campaign, because, and say, do you really want to be associated with this kind of garbage?
Well, I tell you, the interesting part of this is that he's sort of fallen in line with this, you know, white replacement theory, but he's staying away from the voting restrictions. And the reason he's staying away from the voting restrictions is because you have companies out there that have basically taken a stand. And if he goes down that route, that's where he's probably going to lose advertisers. So if there's any kind of connection between this replacement theory and voting restrictions, now he's going to fall over into that point where Fox is going to go like, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, you know? This is race baiting. It's pure and simple race baiting. And the question is, how long are advertisers going to want to be associated with that? I mean, I reviewed a book. John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, just came out with this book. And I thought one of the most striking anecdotes in that book was he talked about when he was Speaker of the House, leader of the Republicans in the House, making a special trip to New York to meet with Roger Ailes, the then head of Fox, to say, please tone it down. It's making it really hard for me to get any work done and do the kind of compromising we have to do. And he said Ailes just came at him with all these weird conspiracy theories. And he says in the book, I walked out and I was horrified, you know, that I couldn't believe what I was hearing. So when you hear even mainstream Republicans like that talking that way about this organ, you just have to say at some point, you know, money talks.
Right.
And I think the money's going to have to talk here. But I think when you see a John Boehner calling it out, that tells you how far things have gone. He said Roger Ailes was his friend, but he thought he was way out of line.
Yep.
Okay, so here in Missouri, we are finally at the point where everyone, 16 and older, who wants a COVID vaccine is now eligible to get one. Only one of the two vaccines approved for use on those under the age of 18 has been paused, as the FDA and CDC say that they want to look a little bit more closely at the safety of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So there have been six women who have had some unusual side effects leading to blood clots to the brain. One of them has died. As I was watching the reports about this yesterday, one of the things that struck me was how often I kept hearing the news anchors say, especially as they were interviewing medical experts, how many times Dr. Sanjay Gupta on CNN was saying, this is 6 out of 7 million, that they were trying to keep that context so strong so as not to further feed vaccine hesitancy, which now that there is so much more open availability, we're seeing higher rates of it, that the people who really wanted the vaccine were getting them in the early phases.
I mean, that's one of the vaccine hesitancy is really what they're combating here. Mm-hmm. They understand that when you bring out a vaccine like this, especially something as controversial as this has been all the way throughout, that any kind of news that comes out that's perceived as negative only exacerbates the vaccine, the hesitancy of people to take the vaccine. And that's one of the things that they're dealing with right now. And they're trying to get the CDC and the FDA and others to move quickly to determine what are the things that we need to do in order to be able to alleviate this problem. Because the longer this is out there, and you've seen it with AstraZeneca, the longer it's out there, the more problem it creates in terms of people not wanting to take the vaccine.
Yeah, I think one thing we know we've been bad at in the media is assessing risk in a sensible way. And as you point out, it's literally less than a 1 in a million chance that you're going to have a bad side effect from the vaccine, as opposed to, you know, I haven't run the stats, but it's a much greater chance that you're going to end up in the hospital seriously ill from COVID.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we need to keep putting that in perspective. It doesn't mean there's no risk, but there's no risk in anything. You know, I mean, when
in
I walk out of the
door,
walking out the door in the morning, there's a risk. So what's your tolerance?
So one of the things, too, that they have been talking about, and it's kind of like, and I want to mention that the person who asked me this question is a very dear friend and was asking me this question entirely from a point of being respectful and asking. But as he was learning more about blood clots and how blood clots can affect women of a childbearing age, said to me, did you know that the birth control pill can cause blood clots? I said, well, yeah. In fact, at much higher rates than one in a million. So that context remains a really important piece of that.
Exactly. Right. And I think, you know, the other interesting thing when you talk about people going on the air and really making this point, this is another thing we're not good at as journalists, is reminding people that we're part of the community too.
Right. Yeah.
And we're rooting for you. And I don't know about anybody else, but I'm going to go out there on a limb and say, this is what I want. I want to be able to go into a classroom in the fall without seeing my students behind masks. Right. I want to see their little faces. I want to be able to go to a ball game and cheer without hearing the cheers muffled behind masks. I'm a journalist. That's what I would like. I think a lot of people would like that too. So I think everybody is who has reported on this and has some idea of what exactly the context is, they want the community to be better, and we all do, and getting a vaccine is one way to get it there. Yeah. Let's play ball.
Okay. Yeah. Before we have all the baseball analogies this week. Before we go, I promised everyone one more clip from Saturday Night Live's Cold Open.
So what else is in the news, Joanne?
Well, more sad news this week. Unfortunately, we lost royalty yesterday.
Oh, I'm glad you brought this up.
Yes, the rapper DMX died.
I was talking about the prince.
The prince?
Girl, Prince been dead.
Sorry, no, she means Prince Philip of England.
Meghan Markle's boyfriend?
He was married to Queen Elizabeth.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, he's the king.
Yeah,
is he the king?
Okay, so let me start by saying again, even though the three of us are sitting around this table laughing, we are not making fun of Prince Philip's passing.
No.
We aren't.
No, we're not.
He was a well-loved man, a diplomat who has done amazing things over the decades. At the same time, in the grand scheme of things, maybe this wasn't the biggest news story of the week. And the BBC learned that one when they got flooded with millions of complaints for the depth of the wall-to-wall coverage that was put on TV.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I mean, maybe the our British cousins are coming around, you know, and on this monarchy thing. I've always been really glad that we don't have one of those. And so I'm pleasantly surprised that they're not. It's a tragedy for a family, but certainly Prince Philip led a long and very well-lived life, and for his family, it's very sad. But is this the biggest news in the world? No, there's a lot of other important stories, some of which we've talked about here.
Ernest, I want to give you the last word on this one, because every time we have a story about the royals, you look at me and say, "We got to talk about them again."
Yeah.
It really does beg the question, given that public response, has the royal family proverbially jumped the shark? Have we reached that point where maybe their relevance isn't so much there anymore?
I think we're there when it comes to the United States.
Okay.
And I think they're sort of getting there when you talk about the UK. I mean, I think the BBC felt they had to do it, but remember, the BBC is also subsidized by the British government, so it would have looked it wouldn't have looked good for them in the eyes of those who are subsidizing
them.
The Queen. Yeah. I'm trying to be a little diplomatic.
I understand.
Why do that, Ernest? Why change now?
Well, with that, we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of our topics on our links blog under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at Views on KBIA. I'd like to thank Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio for us, Tim Pilcher, who composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.